Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to Senate Finance and call the committee to order. It's March 30th, 2009, 4 minutes after 9 a.m. We're going to go by the chairman's time versus the Senate time on the clock. We're having difficulties with our old machine here. We'll get that fixed coming up over the interim. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, and Senator Thomas, and myself, Senator Stedman. We've got three items on the agenda today. We're going to start with Senate Bill 45, Veterans Cemetery Fund License Plates. Then we're going to move to Senate Bill 32, Medicaid Home Community-Based Services. And then we're going to move to Senate Bill 96, Child Support Cash Medical Support. We're going to go ahead and then start with Senate Bill 45, Cemeteries Fund License Plates. We've heard this bill for the first time on February 25th. And at that meeting, we introduced the bill, took public testimony, and adopted Amendment Number 1 by Senator Thomas. Today, the intent is to bring the bill back before the committee for a brief introduction and discussion from the committee. With us today is one of the bill's sponsors. The other one, Senator Huggins, is in transport to Juneau. So, Senator Terrio, if you could please explain to the committee what this bill is, and for the folks at home that are watching the meeting today so they can follow along with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you mentioned, the committee took previous action by adopting Amendment Number 1, which was offered by Senator Thomas. If you recall, the bill is broken down into a couple of sections. First of all, it allows for a specialty request plate for Alaska veterans. That money then, or funds that are generated through that effort, can be placed into a new Alaska Veterans Cemetery Fund. The funds that are in that account then can be appropriated by the legislature for the creation of a veteran cemetery and also the ongoing maintenance. In addition, the legislation also makes a couple of cleanup changes to the veterans hiring preference that is currently in the statute. Not a substantive change, just more of a form cleanup in the language. And then finally, at the end of the bill, it makes reference to the Alaska Veterans Cemeteries under the Section 9. I believe it is. It makes generic reference to the federal codes so that if those codes change over time, our statute will follow along with them, and the legislature would not, or the statutes would not be out of compliance with the federal codes for any period of time, waiting for the legislature to modify them. Mr. Chairman, also the last time the bill was up, I had mentioned that the Fairbanks North Star Borough had passed a resolution in support of the creation of a cemetery in interior Alaska. The Borough Assembly has passed a new resolution just updating that support to make sure that everyone knows that the current Assembly is supportive of the effort. And with that, I'm available to answer questions. Also, Senator Huggins' aide, Sharon, is here, and McHugh is here also.
Okay, just a brief note for those watching at home that possibly didn't see the initial February 6th meeting. The oldest cemetery, West National Cemetery, west of the Mississippi, is in Sitka, and it is getting near capacity, and there's some expansion issues dealing with that cemetery. Alaska has a very high percentage, if not the highest, I think, percent of the veterans of any state in the Union per capita, and there seems to be limited or no interest from the federal government in doing a national cemetery in Alaska. So the proposal here is to move forward and have a state-sponsored military a cemetery in a location that that's in the state that has access to most of the residents of the state and also a high concentration of veterans. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The sponsor, Senator Huggins, at the last meeting when I inquired about whether or not we could try to address some of these fees be utilized into cemeteries that are operated by municipalities that but are dedicated for veterans. He said that he was willing to work with me. He's not here today, but if it's your intention to move this, I have no problems as long as we get the opportunity along the process of the other body to address that concern.
Okay. We have got the first fiscal note dated February 6th shows $250,000 general fund appropriation starting in FY02. The second fiscal note dated the 23rd of February shows $750,000 general fund appropriations in FY10, the total amount necessary to complete the project. The governor originally set aside $250,000 in the FY10 capital budget, but then she removed the funding. It seems that the governor does not intend to fund this project this year, so I ask that we adopt the first fiscal note dated February 6th, 09, when we have a motion. And with that, Senator Hoffman, may we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for Senate Bill number 45 as amended, with the attached fiscal note February 6th, 09, with individual recommendations.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill from committee with the attached fiscal note dated February 6th, 09, and individual recommendations. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee or referral.
Thank you.
Senator Carrier. The second piece of business today, Senate Bill 32, Medicaid, Home Community-Based Services. This is the second hearing on this bill. We heard it for the first time on March 11th. We set the bill aside to work on a committee substitute. The intent is to adopt the committee substitute, present the committee substitute to the committee, and ask the will of the committee. Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion on the CS version M?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 32 Finance /M as our working document.
We have a motion to adopt version M as our working document. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, working version M is our, version M is our working document. Senator Ellis, would you please explain the...
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
The CS before us for consideration is a work product working with your staff, the committee concerns, and those of the administration. And Mr. Max Hensley was involved with your staff in the details of the CS, and if it's okay with you, he'll walk us through it.
Mr. Hensley, if you want to introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to version M, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Max Hensley, staff to Senator Ellis, and just like to repeat what the senator said. Thank you to your staff and to the administration for working with us to develop this committee substitute. I think it's a better piece of legislation than the one that we brought forth originally to the committee. So it's a simpler bill that significantly reduces the forecasted fiscal impact to the state. At the request of the department, this CS removes the general relief medical programs that were in the CS put forward by the Health and Social Services Committee, to focus the bill on the Medicaid sector, and it maintains the general intent of the bill, but does loosen some of the definitions and language to allow the department in it to implement the bill with minimal staff and significantly lower overhead costs. Pointing to two places in particular, page 2, line 5, replaces the word use at the end of the paragraph with consider, and page 2, line 6, rather than costs, replaces that with periodic cost surveys. These are both ways for the department to achieve the goals of the original legislation with less overhead and administrative burden. And the department, I think, is here to address some of the new fiscal notes, but I would point out that the two new fiscal notes that the committee has received, the first is to maintain funding for three existing positions that were not included in the FY10 operating budget. And the second is to the second fiscal note, the rates, reflects some updated assumptions, but is still a predictive fiscal note. And it should be noted that all of the funding for the rates are to be done within the limits of appropriations by the legislature and this committee. There's two spots within the bill where there are specific cost containment measures. First, at the bottom of page one, a rate established under this section takes effect, does not take effect until approved by writing, in writing by the commissioner. The second, and then on page two, the department shall make the rates within the limit of appropriations made by the legislature for the department's programs under this chapter for that fiscal year. So the fiscal notes you see are assumptions, predictive, but should not be taken as removing the appropriating power of this body.
And could you, Mr. Hensley, in brief for those watching at home that weren't watching on the initial hearing, could you just tell the people at home briefly what this bill does?
Absolutely. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. This bill in general creates a system of regular and periodic rate review for the providers of home and community-based services under the Medicaid waiver program and for personal care attendants. It's something that's provided to our hospitals and nursing homes, and it's not our intent to attack that system, but rather to make an equitable setup for people who provide care in a more cost-effective and less restrictive manner.
Okay. And then we have two fiscal notes, as mentioned earlier, the Department of Health and Social Services. The first note is from support services in an annual general fund match of $182,000.2 to cover the cost of three new full-time positions. The second note is from Senior and Disability Services that shows a zero cost for FY10, FY11. In FY12, there is a $3,076,300 general fund match for increased Medicaid benefit dependent on appropriation. And Senator Ellis, do you have any comments on the bill?
No, I just appreciate all the work that's gone into this to make it, or the suggestions from the department in particular, to make this a good cost management tool, to give the commissioner some discretion. The committee, the legislature, maintains its appropriating power. I think we've made it a better bill.
Would you like to make a motion for the committee?
Were you intending to hear from the department?
Oh, excuse me, yes, we'll slow down here a little bit.
Okay.
We'll bring the department up.
I appreciate your enthusiasm, but we probably ought to put the department on record.
Nobody's ever accused this table of not being efficient in the process. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and walk us through the CS on your comments, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Sherwood. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on this bill, and I appreciate the work the committee and the sponsor has done with the department to get a workable bill. I think as we've looked at this draft M, this is a bill we can live with. We think we have the flexibility we need to avoid having to go to a more onerous, overly structured rate setting mechanism for what are often relatively small providers. And this would, this takes us in the direction I think we intended to go under regulation anyway, but would put this process into statute. So, and I'm available to answer questions on the fiscal notes if the committee so chooses. Thank you.
And we took public testimony on this bill at the last meeting. Senator Ellis,
I
have a question. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. On the fiscal notes, it says right here that there's a note that the amounts do not include inflation unless otherwise noted. So there are no inflation numbers on these fiscal notes?
On this fiscal note, there is no inflation on the administrative cost of the fiscal note. There is, and I believe it's explained in the text of the fiscal note, on the cost for senior and disability services. That does assume not general inflation, but the specific inflation rate for the Medicare Home Health Market Basket Index. That is one of the factors we're to consider in rate setting. It was specifically mentioned, and in an effort to give our best approximation of what the impact of the bill was, we showed that inflation rate moving forward for the services included in the bill from FY 012 forward.
And that, Mr. Chairman, that would be 2.8% per year?
That would be 2.8%, correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What is the department's view on, since you're in favor of the bill with its with its look at what the rates are, what are your thoughts on Section 3 when it gets repealed in 2014?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, Section 3 would repeal the provision that the department report on our rate setting process after as of 2014, and we think that by 2014 the process will be well established and functioning, and we don't anticipate needing to report our annual progress on it. I think we could continue to if that was the will of the legislature, but we had just thought that at some point once the system was up and running, it might be a little bit redundant to have to come back and report every year.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my real question has to do with how do we make sure that those community-based services providers are continuing to get something for their fair market value out on the workplace?
Just to be clear, through the chair, Senator Olson, the sunset provision only removes the reporting provision. The rate-setting provisions maintain in statute, so that does not sunset.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
And I guess my final question, I guess, is the concern that in order to accomplish this, the department saying that they need three additional personnel is...
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we attempted to go out and start this work to develop a rate setting method using cost surveys. Our first efforts weren't as successful as we wanted, although we got some good information. We found that our providers did not keep information there. They did not do their accounting in a way that lent itself to reporting cost, even in a simplified cost survey. Our view is that if we are to make this successful and implement it in the timelines in this legislation, we need to work with the providers to tell them up front what kind of costs we're going to be surveying, how they may need to modify their record keeping to accommodate that, and then we'll actually need to go out and do the surveys and analyze the data and in come up with new rates. And our rate setting office felt this was what would be required to do that and make sure we could do it in the timelines.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't have any problem with that. The problem that I have is that after you do all of that, why do we have to have a continuation of those three positions?
Through the chair, Senator,
because it
Olson
shows the schedule, those three positions would stay on even after you accomplish what you had said.
I think we anticipate having to do the cost surveys periodically. We have new providers coming on all the time who will need technical assistance and education and training in the process, and we would essentially need to keep this process ongoing to make sure that the information we were using was current for setting rates.
And if I could add one thing, Mr. Chair, and correct me if I'm wrong, but these are positions that do currently exist. These people are working in the department right now, and they were scheduled to expire. This would, rather than, it could, you could look at it as instead of creating new positions, maintaining, not cutting old ones. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions for the administration?
Just one point. Can the department verify that comment by Mr. Hensley?
Yes, it's my understanding these are positions. I know the positions are there. I believe they're all currently filled. They were funded under our the previous SB61 efforts to look at Medicaid reform, and this would continue those positions forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ellis.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Bill number 32, Finance, be moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll move the bill from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Your referral. Next bill up, Senate Bill 96, Child Support, Cash Medical Support. This is the first hearing on this bill. My intent is to introduce the bill and take public testimony and then set this bill aside for further work. And with us today is Senator Davis. Senator Davis, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and then go ahead and walk us through the bill, please, as this is our first hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I represent myself. I'm Senator Davis, and I also have with me my aide, Linda, who's going to give an overview of the bill. We do have division people here to speak to it and tell you the importance of having this piece of legislation passed this year.
Senator Davis, what district do you represent?
District K.
District K, the representation.
Yes.
Thank you, Senator. Go ahead and continue. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent or who you work for, and then walk us through the bill.
Certainly. I'm Linda Zog, and I'm the aide to Betty Davis. And what I'd like to do is simply review the sponsor statement and then make room at the table for the division representatives. We are looking at Senate Bill 96. In January of 2008, the federal government issued new medical support regulations that required states to have guidelines addressing how either or both parents will provide for a child's health care needs through accessible health insurance coverage, cash medical support, or both. Under a federal regulation, states must order either or both parents to purchase reasonably priced accessible health insurance coverage, provide cash medical support, or both. Cash medical support may be required in those cases where no reasonably priced health insurance coverage is accessible to the child. If the parent is ordered to pay cash medical support, the Child Support Services Division must enforce the ongoing cash medical support obligation as well as collect any cash medical support arrears. Failure to satisfy these mandated orders jeopardizes $17 million in federal funding for the state's child support program. I should note that information has changed as of Friday of last week that ups that amount considerably, and I think the department, the division, will speak to that. This bill adds to existing law the authority for a tribunal to either order one or both parents to pay cash medical support if warranted. In addition, the bill directs the division to review child support orders for modification on a federally mandated 3-year cycle. The bill adds cash medical support to the definition of arrears and the definition of support orders, thereby establishing the division enabling the division to use existing enforcement tools to collect a cash medical support obligation on behalf of the child. Finally, the bill removes the language limiting who may request the correction of a clerical mistake in an administrative order or request the vacating of an administrative order based on defective information. This bill puts Alaska in compliance with federal regulations, and as explained above, this bill will assure that Alaska's children receive the medical support to which they are entitled. And if we can, if Chairman wouldn't mind, we can have the department folks come up and they can address the specifics.
Right, we'll get to that here in a minute. Okay. The medical payments are retroactive, so they apply to existing orders or only add to the future child support orders?
My understanding is they would apply to existing orders, but that is a better question asked directly of child support.
And are the extra payments for medical care required to be spent on medical expenses, or can the custodial parent use the money for other purposes?
Again, Senator, I think that's a better question to bring forward with the division.
And we have other questions for the bill sponsor before we bring up the department. Okay, we'll have, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We can have somebody from the department that wants to help us with this bill come forward.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ginger Blaisdell, and I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. And online at the Anchorage LAO is John Maloney, who is the Director of the Division of Child Support Services, and also Stacy Steinberg, who is an Assistant AG who works primarily on child support issues. There's a couple of ways we can present the bill. Director Maloney has a short presentation of how the bill would work. He also has a section analysis where he can walk you through the bill. So if you'd like to hear either of those, or if you would just like to go straight to questions.
Well, I think we'll give him the opportunity, Mr. Maloney, to present his presentation, please. If you can identify yourself and who you represent, and then speak to the bill, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Maloney. I'm the Director of the Child Support Services Division. Child support is a federally mandated state-operated program. The federal government provides more than 66% of the funding for the program. In order to secure this funding, the state must comply with the requirements of the Social Security Act and federal regulations in 45 CFR 300-310. Failure to meet these requirements will put at risk federal funding for the child support program. The funding amounts to approximately $17 million per year. This bill addresses three areas where state statutes require change to federal requirements and ensure continued federal funding of the child support program. The first area is the Uniform Family Support Act. The purpose of this act is to provide efficient procedures to collect child support in interstate cases and to eliminate multiple support orders that were permitted under prior child support laws. In 1995, Alaska enacted a version of the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act that contained a different definition of state than contained in the Uniform Act. Following year, Congress passed legislation that mandated the states adopt the Uniform Act to be eligible for continued receiving federal funds for the child support program. In Alaska's Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, the definition of state does not include two entities that are included in the Uniform Act. These two entities are the United States Virgin Islands and an Indian tribe. The bill will eliminate these differences by incorporating these two entities in the Alaska Uniform Interstate Family Support Act statute. The second area is medical support. Recognizing that the state child support program efforts to secure and enforce medical support order had met with limited success, Congress enacted the Child Support Performance and Incentive Act of 1998. The Act directed the establishment of a medical support working group. The working group included 30 members representing federal and state child support programs, employers, payroll professionals, group health plans, and Child and Children's Advocates. The working group's report was delivered to Congress in 2000. In July of 2008, in response to several of the working group's key recommendations, the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement issued new medical support regulations. These regulations require states to have guidelines addressing how both, either or both parents will provide for the child's health care needs through accessible health care insurance coverage or cash medical support or both. Under the federal regulations, states must order either or both to purchase reasonably priced accessible health insurance coverage, pay cash medical support for both. While health insurance coverage is preferred, cash medical support may be required in those cases where no reasonably priced health insurance coverage is accessible to the child. If a parent is ordered to pay cash medical support, the Child Support Division must enforce the ongoing cash medical support obligation as well as collect any cash medical support arrears. The bill adds to existing law the authority to order either or both parents to pay the cash medical support if warranted. While meeting federal requirements, it also assures that children receive medical support to which they are entitled. The third area involves review and modification of support orders. The SSD clients can request a review at any time. If no request is made, CSED currently does not perform a review. Current federal regulations require the state to have procedures under which child support orders must be reviewed and, if appropriate, modified at least every 3 years. The bill requires the agency to perform the reviews in compliance with the review cycle. However, this in no way limits a client's ability to request a review at any time. The SSD has an automated system that collects income information of the parties in each case and once a year performs a calculation to determine if the case meets the criteria for modification. If it appears that a modification criteria are met, notice is sent to both parties informing them that a modification may be warranted. In addition to these federal required provisions, the bill also removes the language limiting who may request the correction of a clerical mistake in an administrative order or who may request the vacation of an administrative order based upon default income. Excuse me. Currently, in both situations, only the obligor can request these actions. That concludes my testimony. I'd be more than happy to take any questions.
Yes, the changing the definition of state, what impact does it or doesn't have in undermining the state sovereignty?
Chair Stedman, I also have Peter Petzia from the Department of Law. He's the Assistant Attorney General who deals directly with tribal affairs, and he can probably speak to that amendment.
Sure. He can introduce himself and who he represents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Peter Putzier. The last name is spelled P-U-T-Z-I-E-R. I work for the Alaska Department of Law, specializing in Indian-related issues. The question was, if I understood it correctly, Mr. Chairman, what effect amending the definition of state to include Indian tribe might have on state jurisdiction? In my opinion, it would not have any effect. The changes are to UIFSA are primarily in the nature of procedural changes in how child support orders are enforced, but they do not affect a substantive change, either expanding or limiting tribal jurisdiction, and conversely, it neither expands nor contracts the state's jurisdiction with respect to child support enforcement authority.
So this is not setting a precedence and won't impact any future court challenges, is what you're telling us?
In my opinion, no, it would not. It leaves the issue of jurisdiction, relative state tribal jurisdiction, it doesn't resolve it and doesn't speak to it. Again, it affects procedural changes in the law, perhaps unfortunately will have still unresolved the issue of tribal jurisdiction, but this bill doesn't, again, either expand or restrict whatever jurisdiction tribes may have on the one hand or the state on the other.
So does the administration support the bill?
Yes, through the chair, the administration does support the bill.
And it appears that there's a request to change a definition of state and an amount of $17 million a year that would be impacted by this bill if we were not, if we don't take action on it in a positive fashion. Is that correct?
Yes. Senator Stedman, the department actually just received a letter from the federal government on Friday, the 27th. And it's called our pre-notice letter. And it describes the need for Alaska to comply with UFSA, especially regarding the definition of state. And in the bottom paragraph on the first page, it says, in addition, in order to be eligible for a block grant for temporary assistance to needy families, which is TANF, and it cites the section, it requires the state to certify that it will operate a child support enforcement program under the state plan approved under Part D. Therefore, Alaska should be aware that TANF funds may also be at risk if the state does not enact conforming child support legislation. And $17 million is the amount of federal funding that goes to the Child Support Services Division. Unfortunately, the TANF grant is also used widely in the Department of Health and Social Services. If the federal government were to restrict the entire federal TANF grant, it would probably equate to about $85 million of a negative impact to the state.
And then could you help the committee with the philosophical differences is of strings attached between this bill and the stimulus issue that's with we're struggling with?
With regard to the child support funding that's in the stimulus
bill? With regard to an issue with federal strings attached to federal money. If we don't, how do we reconcile that issue?
I don't know that I understand the strings attached conversation.
Well, you just told me that there's $85 million on the table if we don't take positive action on this bill. And the federal government's asking us to redefine the definition of state. Is that not a string attached? And if it is, how do we reconcile that with the stimulus bill that's in front of us? I'm trying to sort out what we're dealing with here.
Okay. Chair Stedman, this particular bill is not directly related to the federal economic stimulus package. What this bill does is it says that the state of Alaska must be in compliance with the UFSA Act. If we are not in compliance, we are at risk of losing significant federal funding. The federal economic stimulus bill, as far as child support section is concerned, what it did is in the federal stimulus package, it allowed child support to utilize some of its federal funding as general fund match. And that is just, it's a benefit that was provided to states for the last approximately 5 years, and it would continue it for another 2 years. I don't believe that there is a direct correlation between this bill and the federal economic stimulus package, other than child support is impacted by both.
Well, I understand that. I'm not confused that this is not the stimulus bill.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm confused with the message coming from the administration dealing with bills or requests to the state with strings attached. How do we separate those two issues is what I'm looking at. This is not the stimulus bill. I understand that. And
okay.
Can you help us with that?
You know, I'll have to get back to you because I really don't... I'm not sure how to respond.
Okay, fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Putzier, as you look at the, on page two, where bottom of the page is talking about the state, and it includes Indian tribes in there and realizing that IHS has healthcare beneficiaries that are out there that are dependent for their medical services, and we're dealing with medical support there. Does that in any way jeopardize the continuation of them being able to go ahead and get access healthcare?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'm sorry I didn't understand the question. Could you repeat that for me, please? Okay, I'm familiar with that. Yes.
The way that it's set up now, Indian Health Service beneficiaries have health care provided for them. And since we're dealing with medical support here for child, as well as child support, does it in any way or does it affect those beneficiaries that are out there by having Indian tribes included under the definition of state under line 24 on page 2?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I believe, first of all, I believe that's a technical question that someone who's familiar with the payment flow might be able to answer. But as to the amendment to Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, that primarily goes to how child support orders are enforced as between jurisdictions. That's what it's geared towards, and insofar as that's the topic, I don't believe that that would have an impact on IHS beneficiaries, but that's my off-the-cuff response. I have not looked at that particular question. I'm hoping there's someone who's here today who could answer that for you. I'm sorry I can't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, through the chair, I think Director Maloney has addressed that issue before, so if John can speak to that.
Mr. Maloney, do you want to help the committee with a question?
Chairman, I think I'll let Assistant AG Stacy Steinberg address the question.
Mr. Steinberg, can you help us?
Yes. Stacy? Yes, thank you. Through the chair, my name is Stacy Steinberg. I work for the Department of Law. I'm Chief Assistant Attorney General, and I work in the area of child support. And to answer Senator Olson's question, no, this won't affect them. There's really three separate parts of the bill. There's the what we call the UIFSA provision, the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, where we're changing the definition of state to include the Virgin Islands and an Indian tribe. That's a separate issue, and that's not directly related to the cash medical support provisions of the bill. And then as to the cash medical support provisions of the bill, what it does is it adds to some existing law that the court and the child support agency, when they set a child support order, they're required to consider and determine if health care is available to the children, and that's in current law. What this bill adds is an additional piece to that, where if there is no health insurance available to the children, then the agency or court would consider whether cash medical support would be appropriate because there is no health insurance. And under our current law is that if the children are eligible for Indian health benefits, that is considered, in essence, health insurance because they are cared for. So I don't see this change affecting those benefits in any way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions for the department? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is probably best for the lady that just answered, Ms. Stacy Steinberg. And with the addition of the language, I don't know that it has any great impact on, although we're talking about cash payments here, if it has any effect on employers in relationship to them paying their employees cash, which makes it very difficult to track someone's employment and actually the amount of wages that they earn. And that, to me, has been, with my limited knowledge of it, somewhat of a problem over the years, that people that are paid cash, it almost doesn't obviously show up for there's a variety of reasons that they're paying cash. Is there anything in this bill that bolsters that position a little bit and holds the employers more responsible?
Through the chair, I'd like to defer to Director Maloney. I believe he'd be the better person to answer your question.
Mr. Maloney, you want to tackle the question as we go back and forth?
Through the chair to Senator Thompson. As I understand your question, we're really talking about the underground cash economy where people work for wages that are not reported either to us or the IRS or many other individuals, which is an area in which child support has, in all over the country, has struggled for a number of years trying to be able to attach those wages in some manner, shape, or form. Unfortunately, we would have the same problem for those individuals if, when we do cash medical support, not having that income reported, not being privy to that information, it's still impossible for us to get the, and to withhold that income or to take that income in some manner or shape other than to take it out of an individual bank account or something of that nature.
Follow-up question, Senator Thomas?
Yes, in that case, are we or the federal government in this case, by having some stipulations, making an error in not trying to approach that question or problem?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, the federal government and the child support directors throughout the country have struggled with that for some time. The problem simply is there's no reporting mechanism. I mean, obviously, both child support, the Internal Revenue Service, people trying to collect employment taxes, all of those same individuals are trying to address that problem. And as to date, there has not been a really good initiative that seems to address it.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the department?
Chairman Stanton, you did have a couple of questions earlier that were not answered, and I think Director Maloney can probably answer those. And one of them was if the cash medical assistance paid would be used strictly for medical payments.
Correct.
And he can probably speak to that. And then also if it was retroactive to pre-existing orders or if it only goes forward.
Correct.
I think he can answer both of those.
Okay. Mr. Maloney, would you like to take a crack at those initial questions that were given to the bill sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I'd like to discuss the retroactive one first. Currently, what would happen under this bill would be that we would do a modification to a child support order to include the cash medical support, and it would be prospective from that point. It would not go back retroactive to previous times. It would use that same order that had probably been, and may have been done some time ago, but the actual cash medical support portion of the order would be prospective only. As far as whether the money would have to be used for medical expenses, the answer to that would be no. Once the money is given to the custodial parent, the custodial parent is then the one who's responsible for the spending of the money and using it for the support of the child. This has come up before in just regular child support as to trying to have individuals account for how they've spent the money. And in all the cases that I know of within at least the state of Alaska, the courts have never required the custodial parent, once they take possession of that money, to account for it as to whether it went to child support or whether it would go to medical support either.
Okay. We have any other questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Thomas.
Just one on the same subject I mentioned before, so just one simple question. On page 1, line 10, it says a person commits the crime of aiding the non-payment of child support in the second degree if a person knows, etc. What is that penalty for doing that, for that crime?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, the particular one that you're speaking of, there is a felony prosecution for aiding and abetting the non-payment of child support. There's also the actual act of just non-payment of child support, which can be either a misdemeanor or a felony. And This simply puts the cash medical support as part of that periodic cash support in that statute.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
On that point, why are we putting it in? What are you trying to fix here? Is there specific examples that you can give us that that would address this inclusion?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I don't believe so. I believe that was simply to bring cash medical support into that definition within that particular statute.
But this language is not required for us to be in conformance.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that is correct. It's not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions for the department? We have, seeing no further questions for the department, we have no one on the sign-up list and no one in the audience. So if we can have the bill sponsor come back and... Senator Davis, do you have any closing comments before we set the bill aside? I'd just like to note there is a
thank you, Mr.
1-0
Chairman.
Fiscal note from the Department of Revenue.
I have no questions.
Or comments.
Except to see if there's anything that we need to do to assist you in making any changes that you may suggest.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no other questions for the bill sponsor, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for a future date. Our next meeting is Wednesday, the 1st of April at 9 a.m. There will be three bills on the agenda. Senate Bill 57, Charter School Funding. Senate Bill 109, Education Loans, Supplemental and Family. House Bill 109. And then House Bill 172, State Investment in Education Fund. Is there any other questions before we close the meeting today? Comments? Okay. This meeting is adjourned. We'll see everybody Wednesday. Johnny.